Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and today we're going to go through Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds, Chapter 21, World War II. Starts on page 258 of basically a 400-page book by Robert S. Griffin, which is a portrait of the late William Luther Pierce, who is the leader, founder of the National Alliance, and America's foremost white nationalist during his lifetime. Let's get started. Chapter 21, World at War, Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds. You can find everything that we do, as always, at myvnnforum.com. You're welcome to listen, to share the link with others, to think about what we're saying here, and to become part of it. Join the forum if you'd like. So, Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds, Chapter 21, World War II. Professor Griffin says, I decided that one section of the Pierce book would be a presentation of the topics or themes Pierce has been emphasizing in recent years. I would go through these areas one by one after I had established a context that would put them in perspective. That is to say, after I had gone over Pierce's personal history and basic view of things. I wrote down a list of topics that seemed to capture what Pierce has been focusing on in his radio broadcasts and writings. The Jewish control of the news and entertainment outlets, white racial identity and commitment, immigration and the Browning of America, the globalization of the economy, the failures of white leadership and the limits of mass democracy, public school inadequacies and how contemporary gender roles were off base. I decided the next step was to go through my list with Pierce to see if he saw the categories in the same way I did. When I had finished reading through what I had on the sheet of paper, Pierce quickly offered, "Don't forget the historical theme. I've been very concerned about World War II and its impact on things since." Yes, of course. Not only should it have been on the list, it should have been first on the list. Pierce is engrossed in the World War II period. It is all grounded there for him. Undoubtedly, that is due in large part to the connection he feels to Hitler and National Socialism, or he feels with Hitler and National Socialism. But the most powerful stimulus behind Pierce's consuming interest in World War II era, I believe, is his fervent conviction that this was a monumentally important turning point in the course of Western history. As he sees it, the direction that cultural and political events of Europe and America have taken over the past half century were set in motion by that war. Pierce thinks that if we, and by we he means white people, are to understand our time, we are going to have to get beyond the official version of what World War II was about and take a hard look at what really happened back then, and he is encouraging people to do just that. He sees himself in a tough battle in getting them to do it, however, because he is convinced that there are powerful forces in our society that make any questioning of the prevailing interpretation of those years and any suggestion of an alternative account a highly unwelcome and even condemned and punished undertaking. During the time that I was in West Virginia, Pierce was obviously savoring a book he was reading entitled The Wolf of the Kremlin by Stuart Kahan, K-A-H-A-N. I assume Bob Damaris steered him, or Bob Damars, steered him to the book, suggesting that he might be interested in reading it. Bob takes on the role of recommending titles to Pierce. Pierce had mentioned The Wolf of the Kremlin to me several times, and it was readily apparent to me that he was having a great time with the book. He told me that it was about a right-hand man of Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin by the name of Lazar Kaganovich. Kaganovich, Pierce told me, was the most powerful Jew in the Soviet Union from the late 1920s through the 1930s. In 1929, Stalin had put him in charge of supervising the collectivization of Soviet agriculture. According to Pierce, Kaganovich came to be known as the Butcher of the Ukraine. After I left the property, I read an article by Pierce published in his Free Speech magazine, which deals with Kaganovich. Like everything in free speech, the Kaganovich piece was based on a transcript of one of Pierce's radio programs. I also read three other of Pierce's free speech articles that have to do with World War II. All of the articles, including the one on Kaganovich, begin with an account of an atrocity, the first three by the Soviets, and the last by the Moroccans who were fighting on the side of the Allies, and then go on from there to an explication of Pierce's conception of that period in history. After going through these writings, I have a better understanding of what Pierce was getting at in his references to Kaganovich during his conversations with me, as well as Pierce's overall perspective on World War II. In these next pages, I will weave these four writings together to try to capture Pierce's view of this time in history and its current significance. Pierce's Kaganovich article in Free Speech is called The Genocide at Vinnytsia, V-I-N-N-I-T-S-A. Vinnytsia is a city of 100,000 people in, which, at that time, of course, was a part of the Soviet Union. According to Pierce's account, Germany had invaded the Soviet Union with the aim of destroying communism. Note Pierce's conception of the struggle. Germany was fighting communism. The German army had pushed far into the Soviet Union and had, in Pierce's words, quote, liberated all of the Ukraine from the communists, unquote. Pierce tells us that Ukrainian officials in Vinnytsia told the Germans when they arrived that 5 years earlier the NKVD, which Pierce describes as a Soviet secret police and a counterpart to our own FBI, had executed a number of Ukrainian civilians, farmers and workers, and a few civil servants and priests. The Germans investigated these allegations and proceeded to dig up 9,439 corpses in mass graves in a nearby park and orchard. The bodies of the men had their hands tied behind their back. All of the victims had been shot in the back of the neck with a .22 caliber pistol. Pierce tells us this was a trademark method and weapon of the NKVD. While the men were clothed, many of the young women were unclothed. The Germans estimated that in addition to the over 9,000 bodies they were able to find, there were another 3,000 buried in the vicinity that they didn't find. The relatives of the dead said that the individuals who had been arrested in those years weren't criminals in any conventional sense, but rather were charged with being, quote, enemies of the people, unquote, by the NKVD and imprisoned. As I read Pierce's account of the killings, I had questions about the method of killing. Would they shoot prisoners in the neck? Wouldn't they shoot them in the skull? I asked Pierce about that. The NKVD executioners, he replied, shot prisoners in the base of the skull, right at the top of the spine, so that the bullet would destroy the medulla oblongata, which is the most primitive part of the brain, controlling respiration and heartbeat. That caused certain and immediate death, whereas a shot higher into the head would damage the cerebrum, which controls higher functions, but might not kill the victim. Some writers describe the shot into the base of the skull as a neck shot, but it was really a shot in the lower part of the skull where the head is attached. I saw a cow actually killed that way, shot by a guy leaning at .22 on his arm from maybe 5 yards away into the back of the skull, and the cow flops over and kicks its legs for maybe two or three times, 15 seconds, and boom, it's done. So a .22 can work in a cow, can certainly work in a man. And this was a cow out in a California ranch that had been chewed on by coyotes. Was the reason they were killing it. And then they butchered it. It was fascinating to watch. They had such an efficient little truck with a winch on it that hoisted it up and then swung it around. They chopped its belly, got its guts out to clean it, and then literally the winch did like a all the way around to the middle of the truck, and then boop, they flipped the flaps up perfectly. Such a white thing, such a brilliantly... a truck adapted to a particular purpose. It was kind of cool to see. Pierce, in his article, gives some background to the situation. Ukrainians, he writes, possessed an independent and nationalistic spirit and wanted no part of the Soviet Union from the earliest days after the Bolsheviks came to power following the Russian Revolution in 1917. The Ukraine was the stronghold of kulaks, independent farmers and small landowners. The kulaks didn't take to collectivization of agriculture, and it was Kaganovich's job to break their spirit or eliminate them. One tactic in this overall strategy was a state-induced famine. The NKVD and the Red Army troops would go from farm to farm and confiscate crops and livestock. Pierce reports that the head of the NKVD during this period was a Jew by the name of Genrikh Yagoda. G-E-N-R-I-K-H, last name Yagoda, Y-A-G-O-D-A. Pierce claims that there was a preponderance of Jews in the NKVD. Pierce puts the number of kulaks who died of starvation in 1934 and 1935 at 7 million. And, you know, I've always heard that like the kulaks were the richer farmers, but then I read something recently that said they're just anyone who is a farmer. So it would be more equivalent to German Bauer, I guess. Maybe someone out there better educated than me knows both German and Russian and could remark on that. But that in itself would show the political bias in even talking about kulak. They're trying to create them as some kind of exalted class. So even the idea in the West by people who are overtly anti or claim that they're anti-communist can be misled into thinking that the kulaks were richer than they actually were, when in fact they were basically like anyone who armed any kind of farming equipment. And here's the Jew leading the NKVD and the as well as the collectivization movement, and they're going around stealing all their livestock and their crops and starving them to death. And they're Jews. Genrikh Yagoda and Lazar Kaganovich. Not household names, though, are they? Pierce puts the number of kulaks who died of starvation in 1934 and 1935 at 7 million. There was an NKVD prison in Vinnytsia, Pierce writes. Its normal capacity was 2,000 inmates, but by 1937 and 38, it was packed with 18,000 prisoners. Pierce describes a nightly activity at the prison. Throughout much of 1938, a few dozen prisoners were taken from the prison each night and driven to a nearby motor pool area. Their hands were tied behind their backs, and they were led, one at a time, a few hundred feet to a concrete slab in front of a garage. The slab was used for washing vehicles, and it had a drain at one side with an iron grating over it. Just as the prisoners reached the edge of the slab, they were shot in the back of the neck, so that when they fell onto the concrete, their blood would run into the drain. This was what the NKVD men jokingly called mokri robota, or wet work. And they had plenty of experience with wet work. A truck parked next to the slab kept its engine racing so that the noise of the engine would cover the sound of the shots. While the next prisoner was being led up, a couple of NKVD men would throw the corpse of the previous prisoner into the truck. When the night's quota of victims had been murdered, the truck would drive off with its load of corpses to the fenced-in park or to the nearby orchard where new graves were already waiting. And this wet work went on night after night, month after month. That's end of a block quote. Pierce then goes into why he thinks what happened so long ago in the Ukraine generally and in Vinnytsia specifically matters to us in our time. For one thing, Pierce asserts, these Ukrainians who were murdered were our people, our kinfolk, part of our race. That is important enough, he says, but beyond that, there is the fact that very few people know anything about these events, and the question becomes, why don't they? We hear about what happened at Auschwitz all the time, Pierce notes, but we never hear about what happened in Vinnytsia. Our attention is drawn to the Holocaust constantly, but rarely, if ever, is it drawn to what happened in the Ukraine. Why is that? Pierce asks. Pierce answers his own question. It is because the people who control the flow of information in our society are Jews, and they disseminate what they care about and what serves their interests. To Jews, the Holocaust is important because Jews died there, and the genocide in the Ukraine is not important because Gentiles, non-Jews, died there. And it is to the Jews' advantage, Pierce contends, to keep, quote, rubbing our noses, unquote, in the Holocaust because it makes us feel guilty. They want us to feel that we owe them something for letting this terrible thing happen to them. They are innocent, and everybody else is in the wrong one way or another. That is their image, the image they want to project. The Jews don't want Vinnytsia to come up because they were the guilty ones there. The Jews have been able to paint themselves as the only victims in the war, says Pierce. It isn't going to help their cause to divide the attention and sympathy of the American public between Auschwitz and Vinnytsia, or between those who died in the Holocaust and the millions who perished in the genocide in the Ukraine. It isn't going to help them get billions of dollars every year for Israel from the United States, military strikes against Iraq, Israel's number one antagonist in the Middle East, whenever they want them, or to expropriate money out of the Germans, the Swiss, and others for claim wrongs done to Jews of past generations. If the Ukrainians controlled the news and entertainment networks in America, says Pierce, you can bet that we would have all heard about what happened in Vinnytsia and what happened to the kulaks. But Ukrainians aren't in control of the media, that is the point. The Ukrainians don't control television. They don't dominate the publishing industry. They don't own the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Time, Newsweek, or U.S. News and World Report. And the Ukrainians don't control the motion picture industry. Steven Spielberg is not Ukrainian. We have been getting a falsified version of this time in our history, insists Pierce. It is critically important, he says, that we come to realize this and that we learn the truth about what happened back then, because what occurred during the Second World War set the direction for what has happened since, including what is now going on in the Middle East. The fundamental reality, Pierce contends, is that our government allied with the Soviet government for the purpose of destroying Germany. The Soviet communists were presented to the American public as the good guys and the Germans as the bad guys. We never heard about things like what happened in the Ukraine or in the Katyn Forest, another outrage committed by the Soviets where they murdered thousands upon thousands of the Polish elite in order to decapitate them. Or any of the other atrocities against our people by the communists, says Pierce, because that would have gotten in the way of the program of building up the Soviet communists as worthy allies and setting us up to support and participate in the destruction of Germany. Pierce's mention of the Katyn Forest in his list of atrocities is a reference of what has become known as the Katyn Forest or Katyn Forest Massacre. The Katyn Forest is K-A-T-Y-N. Is in Western Russia. Pierce's version of what happened there sheds more light on his conception of the Second World War and its significance. In September of 1939, Poland was attacked from the west by Germany and from the east by the Soviet Union. Pierce's view of it is that the Germans wanted the part of Western Poland that had been taken away from them after the First World War, much of which had historically been German territory. As for the Soviets, it wasn't clear from Pierce's writing what he considered to be their motivation, so I emailed him asking him to clarify his thinking about that. He replied immediately. Soviet communism was expansionist and imperialist. Furthermore, Russia had historic claims to eastern Poland going back for centuries. In fact, between the so-called Third Partition of Poland in 1795 and the First World War, Poland didn't even exist as an independent state. Russian nationalists never really accepted the separation of Poland from Russia until after World War I, and were eager to correct, quote-unquote, this separation. End of block quote from Pierce. Under strong Jewish pressure, says Pierce, Britain and France declared war against Germany, ostensibly because of Germany's invasion of Poland. What Pierce wants noted is that Britain and France chose not to declare war on the Soviet Union, who had invaded Poland, just as Germany had. The Jews in those two countries and in the United States, says Pierce, hated Germany and wanted to destroy her and were highly enamored of the Soviet Union. Why? Because Hitler was freeing Germany from Jewish influence. Again, note his choice of language. The Jews had a virtual monopoly on certain professions in Germany and on the mass media and had been distorting German culture, says Pierce. Hitler's government was weeding them out of the economic and academic life of the nation and out of the arts. By 1939, two-thirds of Germany's Jews had emigrated. And I think there was like 500,000 Jews in Germany when Hitler took power. In the Soviet Union, in contrast, the Jews were riding high as commissars. Those are like political military men, or the ones who were heading up the politics in the military, and party bosses. The Jews were riding high as commissars and party bosses. In the U.S. and Western Europe at this time, Jews held what Pierce calls a death grip on the mass media and were very influential behind the scenes politically, and they did everything they could to promote a pro-Soviet and anti-German posture in these countries. In Pierce's version of the history of this time, Hitler felt very much wanted to avoid a war with Britain, France, and America, for whom he felt an affinity. However, he thought that his country had been treated unconscionably by the victors in World War I, and he was dedicated to doing something about it. Hitler also hated communism and looked upon the Soviet communists as a threat to all of Europe, and he recognized their hostility to everything he represented and was trying to achieve. In the spring of 1941, massive troop buildups in the Soviet Union, as well as other internal developments there, convinced him that the USSR was going to invade Germany from the east. This circumstance, so claims Pierce, coupled with Hitler's general hostility to the Bolshevik regime in the Soviet Union, prompted him to make a preemptive strike. German troops smashed through Poland and continued on into the Ukraine and Russia. These events set the stage for the Katyn Forest episode. According to Pierce's version of what happened, in 1943, when the Germans entered an area near Smolensk in western Russia, they heard reports from Russian civilians that a large number of prisoners had been murdered in that vicinity by the Soviet NKVD 3 years before, so 1940. The Germans were led to a series of mounds in a wooded area known as the Katyn Forest, about 10 miles west of the city of Smolensk. As they did in Vinnytsia, the Germans dug into the mounds and began discovering bodies. They then called in the International Red Cross and representatives of various neutral countries. 4,000 corpses were uncovered in mass graves, and based on the information they received, the Germans estimated that 11,000 bodies were still missing. The dead turned out to be Polish. They tended to be influential Poles, military officers, cultural and business leaders, intellectuals, and artists. The head of the nation. It's a decapitation. 15,000 of them had been rounded up by the NKVD and shot in the back of the neck. Was the Soviet Union condemned for that atrocity? Pierce asked rhetorically. No, they weren't. They were the good guys, our ally against the awful Germans. Unlike Vinnytsia, the American media did treat the Katyn Forest story some, but the spin put on it was that the Germans themselves were the ones who had perpetrated the massacre. The media and our government certainly didn't want the public to think that our friends, the Soviets, were butchering civilian populations. Better that our people thought that the Germans had perpetrated the terrible deed. That would support the official line that the war must go on to free the Poles from the wicked Germans, who must be made to pay for their actions. And the war did go on, Pierce notes, at the cost of many millions of lives and the physical devastation of Europe, and indeed the Germans were punished, and the Poles and the entire rest of Eastern Europe were turned over to Soviet domination for almost half a century. Pierce says that now historians accept that it was the Russians who murdered 15,000 of Poland's leaders, and that it took place between March and May of 1940, 14 months before the German invasion of the Soviet Union. You can read about it in libraries, Pierce says. An example he offers is the book Death in the Forest, The Story of the Katyn Forest Massacre by J.K. Zawodny, Zowodny. But don't hold your breath waiting for any Hollywood movies about the atrocity, Pierce cautions. And then there was what happened to German civilians at the hands of Soviet military units in East Prussia after the war. Pierce writes, often the men were simply murdered on the spot. The women were almost without exception gang-raped. This was the fate of girls as young as 8 years old and old women in their 80s, as well as women in the advanced stages of pregnancy. Women who resisted rape often had their throats cut or were shot. Very often women were murdered after being gang-raped. Many women and girls were raped so often and so brutally that they died from this abuse alone. Pierce quotes a directive to Soviet troops from a Jewish Soviet commissar by the name of Ilya Ehrenberg. Kill! Kill! In the German race there is nothing but evil. Not one among the living, not one among the yet unborn, but is evil. Stamp out the fascist beast once and for all in its lair. Use force and break the racial pride of these German women. Take them as your lawful booty. Kill! As you storm onward, kill, you gallant soldiers of the Red Army. By no means were all Russian soldiers butchers and rapists, notes Pierce. For instance, there was a captain in the Red Army by the name of Alexander Solzhenitsyn who was in Germany in 1945. Captain Solzhenitsyn wrote about a scene he witnessed in the town of Neidenberg, Neidenberg. 22 Heringstrasse. It's not been burned, just looted, rifled, a moaning by the walls, half muffled. The mother's wounded, still alive. The little daughter's on the mattress, dead. How many have been in on it? A platoon? A company, perhaps? A girl's been turned into a woman. A woman turned into a corpse. Solzhenitsyn on what went on in Germany. Pierce claims the Jews don't want us to know what happened to the Germans after World War II, or for that matter, during it. He gives as an example the firebombing by the Allies of the civilian German population in the city of Dresden. The Jews don't want us to see that the Germans were victims too, Pierce argues. The Jews suffered and the Germans didn't. That is what they want us to think. Similarly, the Jews don't want us to think about the millions of others of our people who died at the hands of the communists in the Ukraine and in the Siberian gulags. We are told that children in school have to learn about the Holocaust because it was the greatest crime in the history against mankind in history. But the genocidal atrocities against our people matter too, Pierce writes. The truth of it, he says, is that many persons besides the Jews suffered enormously in that catastrophe known as World War II. But for the lies we were told, says Pierce, we would have never allowed ourselves to become involved in the war in Europe, even with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. If the information we received had not been so controlled and so slanted, so biased, perhaps Eastern Europe wouldn't have wound up in the hands of the Soviets to be plundered for so long. If we had known something other than the story we had been fed, perhaps communism would have been crushed in Europe decades before it was. And perhaps Korea and Vietnam wouldn't have happened, and the 100,000 of our best men who perished in those conflicts would never have died. And perhaps we wouldn't be pouring billions of dollars every year into propping up Israel and doing its bidding in the Middle East and alienating the Arab nations in the process. But we didn't hear the truth then, maintains Pierce, just as we aren't hearing the truth now. White people ought to be concerned where any part of our history is suppressed from us, says Pierce. We ought to find out why it happened and how it happened. If we understand things like Vinnytsia and Katyn, it might help us ensure that this kind of thing doesn't happen in the future. Understanding these obscure events that took place so long ago might contribute to a realization among us that we can't trust the mass media or the government in Washington that dances to the tune of the Jews. Pierce says he knows that his message is not a welcome one to many Americans, but nevertheless he believes Americans need to hear it. Block quote Pierce. There were a lot of decent Americans who fought in the war in Europe, anti-communist Americans. Many of them don't want to think about the fact that they fought on the wrong side. I believe that knowing the truth is far more important than protecting our carefully nurtured belief that we were on the side of righteousness. I believe that understanding how we were deceived in the past is necessary if we are to avoid being deceived in the future. Griffin. But while Americans need to hear this alternative perspective on the war, there are many, according to Pierce, who would keep them from hearing it. He says that if he had written or said any of what he did in this article in Canada or Britain, it would have been labeled hate speech, and he would have been shut up immediately. This could happen in this country, says Pierce, if those who don't want what he says to be allowed expression have their way. Pierce acknowledges that those who want to make sure that people like him are silenced are articulate and highly persuasive in their arguments, and that many well-intentioned people support them in their efforts. But see through what they are up to, implores Pierce, and don't let them get away with it. I mentioned to Bob Damaris that World War II had come up in my conversations with Pierce. He reached over to a table next to his desk and picked up a book and handed it to me. "Have you read this?" he asked. "It is about some women who opposed America's involvement in World War II. Why don't you take it with you?" I thanked Bob and went on my way. As we move on to page 267. The book Bob gave me was entitled Women of the Far Right by Glenn Jeansonne, Jeansonne. The book tells the story of an organized right-wing women's movement in the 1930s and 40s that centered its efforts around opposing America's involvement in World War II. Jeansonne provides sketches of the women who led this movement and the organizations they created. It quickly came home to me that this was no minor phenomenon I was reading about. At its peak, the Confederation of Women's Groups that conducted this campaign against the Franklin Roosevelt administration and its supporters had a membership of 6 million members. I was staggered to read those numbers. I had always associated large-scale anti-war activity with Vietnam. My image of World War II, in contrast, was that of the good war that everybody, or just about everybody, supported. What I was learning in the Jeansonne book cut some holes in that picture I was carrying around in my head. Also, as I read along in the book, I was increasingly taken by the fact that I had never heard of any of these women. After I left West Virginia, I found out that I wasn't alone. I mentioned some of these women's names to several generally informed people, and they hadn't heard of them either. It appears that even though these women were well known in their day and they have been blotted out of mainstream history, they are not part of the story of this country, and we have been told, that we have been told that we share as a people. Reading the Jeansonne book raised the question for me of how that happened, And it got me thinking about what difference it makes now that for all practical purposes, these women never existed. Well, the Jews create a false history of the country in order to indoctrinate the youth of their enemy young, the Goyim, your kids. And they simply write out all the white heroes and replace them with colored heroes and bogus atrocities that they claim that they suffered to sucker whites into feeling bad for them and paying for them. Although the women depicted in the book saw themselves as champions of woman, they stood out in stark contrast to today's feminists. Of course, one obvious difference is that their reactionary politics is on the opposite side of the political spectrum from the vast majority of modern feminists, who tend to be on the left in varying degrees. These earlier women were highly nationalistic and patriotic. They were ardently anti-communist and pro-capitalist, and their political antipathies and allegiances were at the forefront of their personal and organizational agendas. That is to say, they were more than advocates for women. As they saw it, gender issues were embedded in larger social-political concerns and needed to be confronted within this broader context. As well, their orientation was in the first instance maternal. They saw themselves as mothers. They approached things from that perspective. Only mothers, they believed, could save their sons from the slaughter and the war that was impending. Also, these women supported sexual abstinence before marriage, and they upheld the traditional nuclear family, which in their eyes included a strong and vital patriarchal presence. These women didn't set themselves off against men. Men, their husbands and sons and other men, weren't them to these women. They were part of us. These women didn't paint men as oppressors or competitors or adversaries or see them as needing to be held in check or reconditioned. Another difference in contrast to feminism's coolness toward organized religion, these women tended to be avowed Christians. And a last contrast, while Jewish women have been disproportionately represented in today's women's movement, these earlier women were markedly anti-Jewish in their attitudes. The first mothers' organization was formed in 1939, just after Germany invaded Poland and Britain entered the war. Three mothers of draft-age sons, Frances Sherrill, Mary Sheldon, and Mary Ireland, started a group called the National Legions of Mothers of America. The purpose of this new organization was to oppose the use of United States troops, except for defending the country from attack. By the end of the first week, 10,000 women had joined up. One of the new recruits was quoted as saying, "I have a 21-year-old son, and I am going to fight for him. It was too much trouble to bring him into the world and bring him up all these years to have him fight the battles of foreign nations." By 1941, the NLMA claimed 4 million members, National Legion of Mothers of America. The most prominent woman to emerge on the far right during these years was Elizabeth Dilling. Dilling described herself as a, quote, super patriot, and said that the real threat in Europe to us wasn't fascism, but communism. Dilling's anti-communism took on racial overtones, as she claimed that the interracial idea, as she referred to it, was one of the strongest dogmas of socialism-communism. She said that the left promotes interracial sex, and that if they get their way, the races will be molded into one big mass. Dilling contended that the left had duped everybody into seeing fascism as the big enemy when in fact it defended property, supported religion, promoted class harmony, battled communism, and presented no threat to us. As far as Dilling was concerned, getting into the European war on the side of the communists in the Soviet Union was joining forces with precisely the wrong side in the conflict, and that in any case, sending our boys across the ocean to fight in a European war would result in young lives being lost, disruption of family life, and a stain to the social fabric of this country. Dilling was very hostile to the women's movement on the left, which she argued had, quote, tried to get women enthusiastically to prefer bricklaying to feminine pursuits, unquote. She also became increasingly hostile to Jews. She claimed that she did not set out to oppose Jews, but that the fact of the matter is that, quote, no one with open eyes can observe a red parade, a communist, anarchist, socialist, or radical meeting anywhere in the world without noting the prominence of Jewry. Well, no one except Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and the rest of the cuckservatives today. They were made of better stuff back then, our foremothers. Referring to Emma Goldman, the leftist Jewish atheist, Dilling asked, Have women like me who believe in beautiful Christian ideals, the right to sit in their rose-shaded living rooms while the Emma Goldmans fill the platforms with their dirt and anti-American ideas? So even the weak-ass Christians back then dared to say boo to the Jew. Unlike today, this dealing would be a Sarah Palin and would be sucking the ass of the Jews even as they mocked her in the media. Whatever else can be said about Dilling, nobody can deny that she worked hard. She toiled from early morning to midnight every day of the week at the cause she had taken to heart. Dilling wrote and toured the country tirelessly. By 1939, audiences for her lectures and speeches had grown from hundreds to electrified thousands. So there you go, for people who say women have no place in politics. If you can do it, you're qualified. See, that's the way I've always looked at it. Now, generally, it's going to be a man, but it needn't always be. If a woman can do it, why prevent her from doing it? Provided, you know, it's not subsidized. You're not giving her special terms. If she can do it on her own terms, that's the masculine ideal. She's living up to it. In opposition to the Lend-Lease Act, legislation which provided American arms to the British and, in her eyes, paved the way to sending our boys to die in Europe, Dilling led a parade down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington. Women marched in twos and carried banners that said, "Kill Bill 1776, the Lend-Lease Act, not our boys." A mass rally followed the march. Among Dilling's other activities in opposition to the war was that she was sure was coming. She organized a demonstration of 25 women outside of the office of a senator who was reputed to want the war. When the women sat down and refused to leave, Dilling and one other woman were arrested and the others ejected from the corridor. Dilling was later convicted of disorderly conduct for the incident. While World War II was in process, Dilling was given to say things like, quote, "Any professed servant of Christ who could aid the church-burning, clergy-murdering, God-hating Soviet regime belongs either in the ranks of the blind leaders of the blind or in the ancient and dishonorable order of Judas." This sort of thing got her arrested and brought to trial for violating the Sedition and Smith Acts, namely undermining the morale of the armed forces in wartime. The case was eventually dismissed, but it did serve the purpose of putting a crimp in Dilling's activities by tying up her time and draining her financial resources as she had to come up with legal fees and other costs of a trial far from home. After the war, Dilling kept right on going, crusading against communism, racial integration, the income tax, and the growing power of the federal government until her death in 1969. Catherine Curtis was another prominent woman on the extreme right during those years. Curtis was considered to be the most effective organizer among women of her ideological stripe, and she became the leader of the coalition that included the National Legion of Mothers of America. Curtis argued that getting into a war would involve mothers turning their sons over to the government and would negate their work of nurturing their boys from cradle to the grave. She shared with the others in this movement an antipathy toward Jews, whom she saw as dominating banking, politics, and the entertainment industry to the detriment of the rest of the country. In 1935, Curtis founded the Women Investors of America. This organization tied rightist ideology to the achievement of women's rights and sponsored talks by Curtis and others on financial matters. Curtis looked upon the development of women's financial capabilities not as a way for women to achieve independence of men or family, but rather as a means of guarding and augmenting the family pocketbook. She also thought that women's financial expertise could guard the nation's pocketbook as well, and thus serve as a buffer against communism. And then there was Lyril Clark Van Hynning, L-Y-R-L, Clark Van H-Y-N-I-N-G. By the early 1940s, Van Hynning's organization, We the Mothers of America, had 150,000 members nationwide. Its male auxiliary was called We the Fathers of America. Van Hynning reflected the anti-Semitism characteristic of this group of women as she blamed Jewish international bankers for getting the United States into the war and circulated a recall petition against members of Congress she said were responsible for doing their bidding. Van Hynning strongly opposed the Normandy invasion in 1944, an event that has been brought back to the nation's attention in recent years by Steven Spielberg's film Saving Private Ryan. A few weeks before the invasion, Van Heining said, "Those boys who will be forced to throw their young flesh against that impregnable wall of steel are the same babies mothers cherished and comforted and brought to manhood. Mother's kiss healed all hurts of childhood, but on invasion day, no kiss can heal the terrible hurts, and mother won't be there. Mothers have betrayed their sons to the butchers." Reading this passage, a contrasting image to Van Heining's stridency and defiance came to mind. The Iowa mother in the Spielberg film who lay crumpled on the floor at the feet of military personnel who had just informed her that three of her sons had been killed in the war. Modern feminists have nothing good to say about women like Dilling, Curtis, and Van Heining. To them, it is virtually inconceivable that women would presume to link right-wing ideology and political activity with the promotion of women's rights. When they speak of these kinds of women at all, they paint them as dupes of males and betrayers of the true interests of women. Gerda Lerner has stated that these sorts of women have internalized the idea of their own inferiority and that this has led them to participate in their own subordination. Hester Eisenstein says that they have been brainwashed to believe that they need men to protect them. A third contemporary feminist, Andrea Dworkin, calls them reprehensible, and all three of those are Jews. But there is still the overwhelming reality of the Holocaust. Apart from anything else, didn't that horror make any view other than the war as a victory of good over evil beside the point? I needed to hear what Pierce would say about this. "Most people who hear your criticism of our involvement in World War II or your condemnation to the Jews," I began, "will very quickly dismiss you with a reference to the Holocaust. Of course, that is why we were in Europe, to put an end to the Holocaust. I just read Alan Dershowitz's book, Chutzpah, and he labels as a bigot anyone who denies the accepted version of 6 million Jews being killed and the use of gas chambers as means of extermination. What is your perception of the Holocaust?" "Before I began reading a lot of history when I was on the faculty at Oregon State University," Pierce answered me, "I had a generally sympathetic attitude toward the Jews. I'd accepted the Hollywood propaganda line that the Nazis were terrible creatures who took all these sensitive violin-playing, philosophizing, poetizing, harmless people and brutalized and killed them, 6 million of them. But then I started reading some books that weren't on the approved reading list. One of the books, as I remember, was put out by a Catholic social agency in Germany or Austria, and it was about the atrocities committed against German civilians after the war. I think it was called The Tragedy of Silesia." I later found the book, edited by Johannes Kaps, K-A-P-S, and published in Munich in 1952. The book was written by priests and has first-person eyewitness accounts of what happened to Germans after the war. Horrible stuff. Whole families being raped and their throats cut. Children tortured to death by drunken Red Army soldiers. That kind of thing on a massive scale. It hit me that I hadn't been exposed to that kind of information before, and it led me to read other things. I came away from this period with a much broader perspective on atrocity and genocide during this period of the 1940s than I had had before. I remember a photograph in Life magazine of a 15-year-old girl who had just been gang-raped by a group of Poles on a train bearing German expellees from the Eastern Territories. I have that photograph in my files to this day because it so struck me when I saw it and read the caption under it. It turns out that hundreds of thousands of German girls were raped. Why, I wondered, where all these terrible things happened, do we only hear about what happened to the Jews? I'd never heard of what happened to the Germans until I dug material out of the back shelves of libraries. It certainly wasn't on television. Schools weren't talking about it. In history classes, the answer I came to in response to my own question is that we don't hear about what happened to the Germans because the Jews don't want us to. With the power they have over the media and the power they have politically, they are able to publicize and capitalize on what happened to them and suppress information about what happened to anybody else. The result is that they have a monopoly on victim status, and that is a good card to have in your hand. The next question I asked myself was, if the Jews have the power to control what people learn about who got raped or killed during that time, they don't absolutely have to be telling the truth, for who is going to challenge them? So I began looking into the details of the so-called Holocaust. Of course, it is a lifetime job to try to get at the bottom of that situation and figure out exactly what happened. but I did find what I took to be credible evidence that some of the Holocaust stories were simple lies. I came to the conclusion that the Holocaust story isn't wholly true. So then the big question is, what parts are true and what parts aren't? And the only way to get at that is to deal with it piece by piece. You have to take a particular claim, I saw them gas 10,000 Jews on March 19th or whatever, and look at the evidence. Could this have happened? Did it happen? And if it didn't happen as the story had it, what did happen? Each one of these is a full-fledged project for some historian or graduate student. Anyway, I learned about enough things that have been falsified, exaggerated, or distorted that I became what Mr. Dershowitz would call a Holocaust denier. Actually, I think that is a deliberate misnomer, because I don't deny that Jews were killed. The Germans wanted to get rid of the Jews. They started by forcing them to emigrate as soon as Hitler became chancellor, by passing various exclusionary laws that cut the Jews out of one sector of German life after another. Jews couldn't publish newspapers, except ones for their fellow Jews. They couldn't teach in regular schools, only in Jewish schools. Jewish attorneys could only have practices serving their fellow Jews. The result was that before the war started, 2/3 of the German Jews had left the country. And that really was Hitler's aim. He may have had a secret desire to cut a few Jewish throats, but his main goal was to get them out of Germany and off the Germans' backs so that Germans could do things their own way. And then, of course, the war came along, and a lot of Jews did end up in concentration camps. And some Jews were executed, particularly in the East, and many Jews died of typhus and malnutrition. I have personally talked to Germans who participated in shootings of Jews in the East, and these included mass shootings, often done in reprisal for something that had occurred. Germans would put Jews into ghettos in Polish, Russian, and Ukrainian areas. Jewish partisans would kill a German soldier or something, and 100 Jews would be rounded up and shot. But never once did I talk to a German who knew anything about gas chambers as execution devices. And these were people that I am certain trusted me and talked frankly with me. So I'm not a denier in the way I would define a Holocaust denier, but I certainly do not believe the Holocaust in its official version. And it is clear to me that this official version is very important to the Jews, and it is not because of justice. It is because they can exploit the victim status it grants them, because of the guilt it generates in the rest of us. Oh, we let this happen to these poor people. How can we compensate them? It would be unfair to criticize them for anything because they have suffered so much. We have to give the Jews anything they want. This has been drilled into our people, and the Jews take advantage of it. I can understand why they get frantic if anybody dares to say, hey, did this really happen the way you describe? They shout, he's a denier. He must be punished. He must apologize. Griffin, is there anything that leads you to believe that there was a policy of extermination? There was a conference in 1942, I think it was, attended by Eichmann and others, where it is said it was decided. Pierce, I presume that most of what took place on the German side during the war, except for perhaps the last days, was based on policy. The Germans had the best disciplined army, and they were not inclined to do things unless they had a policy. Let's say that in the event of German soldiers being killed by partisans, you may or must or should take so many Jews from the ghetto and dig them a trench outside of town and then shoot them. The British historian David Irving has said that there is no evidence that there was any policy for the general extermination of the Jews. That makes sense to me because while we don't hear about it, there were a lot of Jews that lived in Germany throughout the war, and everybody knew they were Jews, and yet nobody bothered them. Victor Klemperer wrote a diary as a good example of that, if you want to look up a book and read it. If there were a policy of general extermination, those would be the ones who would have been rounded up first, and yet they weren't at all. I haven't seen any credible evidence to support the Auschwitz picture Steven Spielberg has painted. The gas chambers we know about were delousing chambers. They were used for sanitation purposes. The crematoria of the sort that were at Auschwitz were also found at every other prisoner of war camp, and nobody is contending that gassings were going on in all these other places. People died in these places and corpses were cremated, but certainly the crematoria that existed at Auschwitz could not have processed the incredible number of bodies the Jews claim were handled in this way. They have said that 4.5 million were killed in Auschwitz. Simple arithmetic shows it couldn't have happened that way. Confronted with that, the Jews say, oh, well, okay, so they didn't dispose of all the bodies in the crematoria. They threw the bodies into big pits they had dug and set fire to them. Perhaps, but I haven't seen any credible evidence of that. I have seen photographs of Germans shooting Jewish and non-Jewish partisans. Why are there no credible photographs of Jews being gassed? All we have is a collection of stories. The Germans had two types of camps. Concentration camps like the ones we had in this country for the Japanese, where elements of the population they considered hostile or dangerous were concentrated so they could be dealt with without posing a general threat to the rest, and work camps. Auschwitz was primarily a work camp, where they produced synthetic rubber. To me, the concept of a death camp doesn't make sense. If extermination were in fact the policy and I were in charge of implementing it, I don't think I would go to all the effort to send them by rail from one part of Poland all the way to another part and put them in a camp to gas them. I wouldn't bother to build barracks and other facilities. I would do what the communists did, shoot them in small batches near where they were arrested. My belief is that the Jews not only greatly exaggerated their losses, but they embellished the details to make them more dramatic, memorable, and shocking. For example, the Jews have told about German soldiers grabbing Jewish babies by the legs and swinging their heads against brick walls. I don't believe it. The German soldiers simply didn't act that way to any extent at all. That is just not the kind of people they were, and certainly nothing like this happened as a matter of policy. I can imagine a rare instance where a drunken German soldier separated from his unit and angry about the bombing of German cities might commit an individual atrocity, but beyond that it doesn't fit. It is an invention to horrify Gentiles and make them think, oh, those poor Jews and those terrible Germans. How can we ever compensate for this awful thing that has happened? There are these stories about Jews getting off the train at Auschwitz, and a German officer walks up and down the line and says, you, and you, go over there to be gassed, and in some cases knocks them down on the platform and pours gasoline on them and sets them on fire. And then there are the stories of Germans throwing children off roofs at the cobblestone below for sport and shooting people like target practice. Doesn't fit. An invention. But the way the Jews have cooked it up, if you question any of these stories, say, hey, wait a minute, did you really see that occur? What was the date? What were the units of the German army involved? Try to pin it down at all and the Jews will say, I can't remember things like that, or we weren't allowed to look at their shoulder patches, or whatever. If you start getting into the facts, the Jews get hysterical, weeping and wailing, or accusatory, and try to shame you. Isn't 6 million enough? Are you trying to crucify us all over again? They want to keep it like a religion where you dare not question. It is like what went on during the Crusades. They come back in 1056 or something and say, this is a piece from the true cross. Someone comes forward and says, I'm not sure I believe it. Let me check it and see how old the wood is. He'd be stoned to death. Didn't some Germans testify after the war that they operated the gas chambers? There were some notorious confessions after the war, but I think torture was involved. The commandant of Bergen-Belsen, named Hoess, H-O-E-S-S, signed whatever they told him to sign after they worked him over, and there were a few others. But if this really happened the way the Jews said it did, there would have been statements of all sorts, including ordinary German soldiers, and much more documentary evidence, and there isn't. You obviously don't accept the numbers of 6 million Jewish deaths during the war. They have shuffled the numbers around a lot. At Auschwitz, the first number was 4.5 million, and then it was 2 million, and then it was 1 million, and not all of those were Jews. And then they said that the ones they thought were killed at Auschwitz were actually killed at Treblinka or somewhere else, but 6 million has become the official sacred number. That is the one you hear from the media. It is rather like the doctrine of the virgin birth, believe it or else. It is very important to know what the real number is because it is a part of our history. Children learn about it in school, and it has influenced so many things in this country, including our support for Israel. The Jews used the 6 million number to get the idea across. You can't deal with us like you would anybody else, because we have suffered so much and you let it happen. So give us what we want and don't ask any questions. They don't say it that blatantly, but that is the tacit message. We really do need to check it out and get the facts. I thought I read somewhere that you estimated that 750,000 Jews died during the war. I can make estimates, but the estimates are not based on sound, hard evidence. I've discovered that a lot of lies have been told about this. So then I have to ask myself, by how much did they inflate their losses? Was it by a factor of 10? 5? 2? It is very difficult at this point to say. My point is that we ought to look at the others besides the Jews who were killed in the war, too. We all know about the 6 million Jews who were supposedly killed in the war. But how many of us know how many American soldiers were killed? And German soldiers and civilians? And why don't we know those figures? Are the Jewish deaths the only ones that matter? At the end of the war, ethnic Germans were expelled from Poland and Czechoslovakia, and millions of them died in the process. Millions of German POWs died in the years right after the war. Who knows about any of that? There are some books in our list you ought to read. One is a book by a Canadian named James Bach, B-A-C-Q-U-E, which describes what happened to the German POWs after the war. Another one is called Flight in the Winter by an author by the name of Torvald, T-H-O-R-W-A-L-D. It describes how the communists would rape and torture and kill German refugees. The deaths during that war have to be put in perspective. That's what I am saying. We've gotten the idea that the only ones who suffered during the war were the Jews. That just isn't the case. After talking to Pierce, it came to me that I really had no idea of the magnitude of loss of life in Europe during the World War II period, so I looked into it. For Germany, there were 4.2 military and civilian deaths during the war, plus another 3.6 million deaths in the immediate post-war period resulting from reprisals against German military personnel, civilians, and ethnic Germans as they were being forced to vacate areas, primarily in Poland and Czechoslovakia, where they had been living. There were a total of 7.8 million German deaths due to the war. Another 5 million Germans were wounded or permanently disabled, bringing total German casualties to 12.8 million. As for the Soviet Union, the estimate is that 18 million people died in the war. I was unable to find the total of Soviet wounded and disabled. The United States suffered approximately 1 million casualties, including around 300,000 deaths. I was able to locate and read the Bach book about the abuse of German POWs that Pierce mentioned. Actually, Bach, a Canadian novelist and amateur historian, has published two books on this general topic. The first, Other Losses, was published in Toronto back in 1989, and the second, Crimes and Mercies, was published in London in 1997. Bach's books recount the mistreatment of two groups of Germans after World War II, the ethnic Germans who were dispossessed from the areas where they had been living outside of Germany, and the German POWs in Allied prison camps. Bach has been unable to find a U.S. publisher for either of his books. In 1990, he told an interviewer from the Toronto Star newspaper that Other Losses had been turned down by a total of 30 American publishers. Crimes and Mercies, the 1997 book, was published by Boston-based Little Brown, but it chose to release the book through its London branch and not in this country. In the introduction of Crimes and Mercies, Bach thanks his London editor who, in his words, took the courageous decision to publish this book despite the harsh opposition it is bound to arouse. Pierce says if Bach's book had been about the mistreatment of Jews rather than Germans, he wonders how much trouble Bach would have had getting his book published in the United States and how much harsh opposition he would have expected. In Crimes and Mercies, Bach tells of the fate of 16.6 million ethnic Germans who were expelled from Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary after the war, many of whom, he points out, had lived in these areas for many generations. Bach calls it the largest ethnic cleansing the world has ever known. He says that ethnic Germans were told to leave their homes in good order, to take only one large piece of luggage and one piece of hand luggage per person living with them. After I left West Virginia, I spoke to an elderly woman now living in Canada who with her family had been among those forced to leave an area of Poland called Silesia. She confirmed what Bach reports and added that her family was also told to leave most of their money behind, although she told me they did manage to get money out by hiding it on their persons. Bach alleges that these Germans were brutalized as they made the trek back to what was left of Germany, or to concentration camps in Poland and elsewhere. He reports that 2.1 million of the ethnic Germans perished before they reached their destination. Bach offers up tales of horror, of Czech guards shooting people at random, of Russians raping German mothers while their small children were present, of nuns being repeatedly raped, of German women having their Achilles tendons cut and being raped by Czech men as they lay on the ground screaming, of dead children being put in coffins, 5 to 7 children to each coffin and buried together. The children have died with their eyes open. The certificate said the cause of death had been starvation. As for the German POWs, Bach reports that in American and French zones, more than 5 million German soldiers were crowded into barbed wire cages. One Allied POW camp was described as huts made out of chicken wire covered with tar paper. Water was supplied by a single tap inside each hut. The water was usually frozen in the winter. The prisoners slept on the muddy ground, 180 prisoners to a hut. In some camps, German prisoners were simply herded into fields and lived out in the open, in holes they dug out themselves. These camps lacked even primitive sanitary facilities, and the prisoners were vastly underfed. The ground beneath them quickly became a quagmire of filth. They soon began dying of starvation and disease. Sometime at the roll calls in the morning, Bach quotes a prisoner as saying, men fell over dead. About 1 million of these German prisoners died in captivity, along with another 500,000 in Soviet camps. Bach's picture contained pictures of these German POWs. Looking at them, I was struck by how different they looked from the image of them I had taken away from the Academy Award-nominated Steven Spielberg film, Saving Private Ryan. As I remember, the German soldiers in the film were older, in their 30s it seemed, and rather dark in appearance, and they had short burr haircuts. The soldiers in the Bach pictures, however, were much younger, teenagers and in their early 20s, and they had fair complexions, and they had light hair, and it was long. I didn't notice any clippered top hairstyles. They looked like kids to me. I pondered how it might have changed the Spielberg film if the German soldiers had looked like the POWs I was gazing upon in the Bach book. One of the German prisoners, a man by the name of Charles von Lutichau, Lutichau, testified about the conditions of one of the American camps. Block quote. The latrines were just logs flung over ditches next to the barbed wire fences. To sleep, all we could do was dig out a hole with our hands and then cling together in the hole. We were crowded very close together. Because of illness, the men had to defecate on the ground. Soon, many of us were too weak to take off our trousers first, so our clothing was infected, and so was the mud where we had to walk and sit and lie down. There was no water at all except the rain, and then after a couple weeks, we could get a little water from a standpipe. But most of us had nothing to carry it in, so we could only get a few mouthfuls after hours of lining up, sometimes even through the night. We had to walk between the holes in the soft earth thrown out by the digging, so it was easy to fall into a hole, but hard to climb out. The rain was almost constant along that part of the Rhine that spring. More than half the days we had rain. More than half the days we had no food at all. On the rest, we got a little K-ration. I could see from the package that they, Americans, were giving us 1/10 of the rations they were issued to their own men. So in the end, we got perhaps 5% of a normal U.S. Army ration. I complained to the American camp commander that he was breaking the Geneva Convention, but he said, forget the convention. You haven't any rights. Within a few days, some of the men who had gone healthy into the camp were dead. I saw our men dragging many dead bodies to the gate of the camp, where they were thrown loose on top of each other into trucks, which took them away. Among other illustrations Bach offers of American abuse of German POWs are these. On General Eisenhower's initiative, the American prisoner of war camps were kept far below the standards set by the Geneva Convention. Japanese General Masaharu Home was shot for maintaining camps in these conditions. At a place called Andermach, A-N-D-E-R-M-A-C-H, German prisoners were trying to nourish themselves on grass. An American college professor reports he saw bodies being taken out of there by the truckload. Prisoner Hans Scharf testified that a German woman and her two children came to an American guard in one of the camps carrying a wine bottle. She asked the guard to give the bottle to her husband, who was just inside the wire. The guard took the wine, upended the bottle in his own mouth, threw it to the ground, and killed the woman's husband with 5 shots. William Kreuznach, a Canadian, reported guards at night would shoot machine guns at random into the camp, apparently for sport. One guard at this camp wrote in his diary, wild shooting in the night, absolute fireworks, it must be the supposed peace. Next morning, 40 dead as victims of the fireworks, in our cage alone, many wounded. Guards would shoot machine guns at random into the camp, apparently for sport. In one of the American camps, there were 18,100 deaths in a 10-week period. That was a rate of 43% of the prisoners a year. In March of 1946, in a French camp, deaths peaked at 25% in 1 month. These are all bulleted points. Prisoner Johannes Heising, H-E-I-S-I-N-G, in a U.S. camp, reported that one night the Americans bulldozed living men into the earth. He is uncertain as to how many of the crowded men were killed in the blackness of the night. In 1996, a mass grave was discovered near an American POW camp. An expert concluded that the bodies were dead prisoners from the American camps, aged 19 to 23. The U.S. Army ration book, smuggled out by an ex-prisoner, shows that these captives were given 600 to 850 calories per day. The prisoners had starved. In Dobbs Ferry, New York, Martin Beach, a retired Unitarian minister, says, quote, "I still experience flashbacks, starving prisoners eating grass and thirsty men bursting through barbed wire and dashing amid gunfire toward a nearby river." Bach concluded, "The struggle has been presented to us as their evil against our good, but as Solzhenitsyn wrote, the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being." I was also able to find the other book Pierce had mentioned, Flight in the Winter. It took some doing to get hold of, since this book, as was also true of the Bach books, was never published in this country and not readily available. As with the Bach books, I had to go through an interlibrary loan process to obtain Flight in the Winter, and that took some time and effort. Flight in the Winter was written by Jürgen Thorwald and was published in London back in 1953. It tells of the events on the Eastern Front in Europe during the last days of World War II. I could see why Pierce referred me to the book. Some of the depictions of the suffering of civilians were jarring and graphic. For example, included in the book is an account of the effect of the British and American air raid on the German city of Dresden on February 13, 1945. Block quote here. "The first wave of heavy British bombers approached between 9 and 10 o'clock at night from the direction of Holland. Between 10:09 and 10:35 p.m., they dropped approximately 3,000 high-explosive bombs and 400,000 incendiaries on the totally unprepared city. The bombing was well planned. The countless incendiary bombs set large sectors of the city on fire, particularly the old quarters. A fierce reddish-yellow glow shone on the departing planes. At 1:22 a.m., the next wave of planes arrived over the city and dropped approximately 5,000 incendiaries. The second wave, guided by the blaze of the burning areas, had only to drop its load into the dark spots to complete the destruction. Their bombs fell into the crowds that had escaped from the already flaming parts of town, collapsing buildings, particularly along the east-west axis that once ran through the entire city, barred the streets and cut off their escapes. Tens of thousands burned to death or suffocated. A firestorm arose with a suction so powerful that it dragged grown people irresistibly into the flames. A third raid about noon rounded out the results of the preceding attacks. It released 2,000 high explosives and 50,000 incendiaries in a city that was already in ruins. Most of the corpses in the city were naked. The firestorm had ripped off their clothes. They were red, puffed up by the heat. The railway station was a scene of havoc. In its basement, 2,000 dead could still be counted. They had suffocated and now floated in the water that had burst from broken mains and flooded the station. In the cemeteries around town, excavating machinery was put to work to dig graves into which 18,000 dead were laid. 6,000 others, some of them parts only, were cremated on a grate that had been constructed in a roped-off section of the center of town. Soon the count was kept only by the number of heads found. 65% of those who were found could not be identified. By April 1st, another 29,000 victims had been removed, but 10 to 15,000 more were estimated to be still buried under the rubble. How about that? Thorwald also tells of what happens to German soldiers and civilians in the streets of Prague one day at the end of the war at the hands of a crowd. He calls it a day as evil as any known in history. The Germans had been herded into a courtyard. The crowd, block quote here, drenched them with petrol, strung them up with their feet uppermost, and set them on fire, and watched their agony, prolonged by the fact that in their position the rising heat and smoke did not suffocate them. They tied German men and women together with barbed wire, shot into the bundles, and rolled them down into the Moldau River. They drowned German children in the water troughs in the street, and threw women and children from windows. They beat every German until he lay on the ground, forced naked women to remove the barricades, cut the tendons in their heels, and laughed at their writhing. Others they kicked to death. That evening, Thorwald writes, a pastor and some elderly peasants stood on the banks of the river downstream from where these events took place. The river brought bundles tied with barbed wire and corpses that had lost their tongues and their eyes and their breasts. It also brought a wooden bed floating like a raft, to which a family, parents and children, had been nailed with long spikes. Those on the shore were able to bring the bed to them and began pulling the spikes out of the children's hands. Sweet freaking Jesus. And that's how that chapter ends. Little taste of reality. But you can't really get very many places, can you? You know what the truth is? It's this simple. All you need to understand the media and history is this fact. The Jews are the bad guys. They're the only people who own the media or need to. And it's just what we've been reading tonight. To portray themselves as the good guys when in fact they are the evil guys. My name is Alex Linder, and everything that I do can be found at vnnforum.com. I want to thank you for listening to me today. Great work by Dr. Pierce and the author cited, and Griffin for putting it all together. This concludes chapter 21, and we'll be right on to chapter 22 and the rest of the book real soon. So thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real quick.